ABC Listen.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The economy, stupid, is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy, Stupid, and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
She describes herself as a little black girl with a guitar. She comes from a family of gospel singers and found her singing voice in the churches of rural Texas. Today, she's an American music legend with 6 Grammy nominations to her name. And this year, her latest album, Mileage, took out the Grammy for Best Contemporary Blues Album. What a treat ahead, an intimate hour with blues, folk and gospel singer-songwriter, the extraordinary Ruthie Foster. Hello, Natasha Mitchell. Excited to join you for this Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and its podcast. I love it when Big Ideas gets musical because music is full of big ideas. It allows us to feel and express what we often can't speak of. Feelings of love and grief and joy and hope. And Ruthie Foster sure has stories to tell about this power of music in her life. She's toured and collaborated with other big names, but she's also forged her own tenacious path. When Atlantic Records wanted to make her a pop star, she refused to sign a record deal with them. From Texas, Ruthie Foster is coming to you today from the Blue Mountains Music Festival for the Heartlands Conversation series, hosted by writer and oral historian Greg Borschman.
Folks, she's come a very long way. Can we have a raucous Blue Mountains welcome for Ruthie Foster? Ruthie, I've got to ask you, please be honest with me. Had you given up five Grammy nominations? You'd been the fangirl at a lot of parties, but you'd never won.
You know, I was actually somewhere else. I decided not to go to Los Angeles. Yeah, I just decided I wanted to be on this. I do a blues cruise every other year. And I thought, and it happened just before the Grammys. And they offered to take me off of the boat and fly me to Los Angeles, but I just really wanted to be with my blues family, my blues cruise fans. And I found out I won while I was hanging out from the boat.
You won it for an album recorded for Sun Records, and this label is America's rock and roll temple. Elvis Presley, Charlie Rich, Roy Orbison, Jerry Lee Lewis, Howling Wolf, Johnny Cash, all recorded for Sun. After 9 previous albums, why Ruthie Foster finally with Sun?
That's a really good question. I had a friend, my producer knew someone with the label. They were good friends, and Dominic was his name. He was interested in what we were writing together. So he really just came to see what we were writing. He sat down and heard the 4 songs that we had in the can, and then I didn't hear from him again. And then I got a call that he was interested in signing me to Sun Records. And I'm not sure why, you know? Maybe they need a little more culture, who knows?
Well, the best part about this story is that it's Ruthie's first Grammy, but catch this, with an artist playlist and a backlist like they've got, this was the first ever Grammy that Sun Records won.
Right? I have no words. I don't know what happened there. I'm just glad of it.
The album Mileage contains a cover song of That's All Right, written in 1946 by Arthur Crudup. And, believe it or not, Elvis Presley's first hit for Sun Records in 1954.
Yeah.
Why would you pick that song?
I think it was important to me after recording it and realizing in the middle of recording it, because that's about one take. I think we only did like one, maybe one and a half. I may fix a few words because I had to catch a flight. And I was trying
that's good,
to...
That's good pressure.
It's like my plane's
Are
leaving.
Are you flying today by any chance?
And I really wanted to bring this song back to the blues and back to the person who wrote it. Big Arthur Crudup is—he was one of those blues writers, blues singers, who was just forgotten about after Elvis recorded this song. In fact, he died in poverty, and I think it's sad that that's how that went down. So this was, and being a blues singer, I thought it would be great to just bring it full circle back to where it belongs, home in the blues. Though I do funk it up a little bit. I give it a little funk.
Yeah, okay. But this is sort of like Ruthie rescuing the blues from rock and roll.
Is that what it, okay.
Well, I don't know.
I didn't say that.
You've often... Quite often, actually, recorded other people's songs. The Let It Burn album back in 2012, it only had two of your songs, but listen to this. Adele's classic, Set Fire to the Rain, June Carter's Ring of Fire, David Crosby's Long Time Gone. When you choose to do something like that, how brave or how respectful do you have to be? Because it's a different universe to you doing your own material.
Yeah, I grew up with this music just like everyone else, you know, in a black household. We listened to these songs and these bands and these groups.
Oh, so you were singing in the shower?
Yeah, I was doing that. Yeah. Not even now. You know, but we had a great, my mother and her brothers, they had a great record collection. I got a record player when I was about 10 years old, and I didn't have any records, so I borrowed records from my family. And I grew up with country music, Conway Twitty, Loretta Lynn, Charlie Rich, and I loved the country Ray Charles album when it came out. I grew up listening to that. So country was, and being in Texas, those were the radio stations, the country radio stations had the strongest signal. So that's what you're listening to if you're in a truck, you know. And then Crosby, Stills, and Nash, you know, that was important to me to record. I actually got a chance to meet David Crosby at a function that Bonnie Raitt put together in California. And I thought it would be really coolness to record something that he wrote, because he complimented me on my singing and my playing that night, and that stuck with me. So it was just kind of, again, just bringing that whole fold into my own, in my own way. I recorded those songs in my own way. If you listen to Ring of Fire, I did something really totally different with it. And I think by doing that, it's such a great song, and doing something kind of subtly sultry with it, it brings people back to the song. And in turn, it opens up that door to country music. So that's what I find with people who just, they discover Ring of Fire and they don't listen to country music. And they're like, well, oh, that's Johnny Cash? So I do get that, and I love seeing that.
Right. In a sense, you were lucky, because we're going to explore these musical roots today. You know, you're born in the Deep South in the 1960s. You've just mentioned David Crosby, but mm-hmm. you also got to meet one of those records in your mother's record collection by Bobby Blue Bland. You once met Bobby Blue. How absolutely other universe-like was it for you in later life to meet some of those people who in your own mind as you were a child must have just been legends already?
Yeah, I fangirl out when I saw Bobby Blue Bland. Yeah, it was on that Blues Cruise boat, and there
oh,
he was.
Oh, no, he was on the boat too.
He was on the boat too.
Yeah. Did he celebrate in the bar with you?
Well, no, he's not with us anymore, so he wasn't on that boat.
Oh, I see.
He was on a previous boat.
Right.
But I was I was a person, the girl down front, you know, waving, and fangirling out. It was just, it meant so much to me to be in the same room, hearing these songs that I grew up with, and the big band behind them, you know, and I'm a big band fan. I've recorded my own big band album. So getting a chance to see that happen, that was huge for me. And, you know, just one of those, check, did that.
I want to come back to the Deep South. You were born in a place called Gores, Texas.
Yeah.
Even the 2020 census, it still only has a population of 275. So I'm guessing this sounds like small town America. Take me back to Gores, Texas in the mid-1960s.
Oh, small. Tiny, tiny. We had and still have one grocery store, post office. The school goes up to eighth grade now, so at the time it was only going to sixth grade, and then they would bus you to a school within the three schools in that county. It was tiny. It was one of those towns where you ride your bicycle to the store and you ride your bicycle back, and if you got into any kind of mischief, your neighbors would stop you along the way. I heard. And, oh, yeah.
That works.
So, yeah. So you get your butt kicked even before you got home. So everybody knew everybody's business. But at the same time, it was a sweet community and a nurturing community.
You were black.
Still am.
You've used that line before, I can tell.
First time.
Did you feel poor?
You know, I didn't. I really didn't. We lived in government housing, but you know, government housing was pretty sweet. It was a pretty sweet little line. We had all of the houses in a row. It was a row of federal houses, but these neighbors that I was surrounded with were just, you know, the communication in this particular community was big for me. It was so huge for me. And my mother was well respected in the community. She was a hairdresser, so everybody would come through our house. The teachers, I grew up with successful, very, you know, these black leaders in my community really helped me, helped develop me into the woman that I am, because
proud,
know that you are worth,
yes,
you are worth something. When you walk into the room, know you belong in the room.
Yeah,
I grew up with that. Very, very intelligent black women in my community and my family.
And men.
Yeah. And men.
I wasn't speaking up for the brotherhood. I was just throwing it out there. You were also very lucky to grow up with books and poetry.
Yes.
You know, before you started writing songs, you were writing poetry. What did you think you were doing?
I don't know. It was really expressing myself. That's what poetry was for me. Reading books by Dr. Maya Angelou, poems by Nikki Giovanni, whom I got a chance to meet and just cried, you know? Gwendolyn Brooks. I read the black poetry, you know, I read black poetry because I connected to that. And to open a book and see words and sentences the way my people spoke, and to see that these women were successful in what they did, and describing who I was and what I looked like. That was huge for me to see that. And so, yeah, it led me straight to writing my own poetry and just writing about my own experiences as a, you know, a little black girl in Gores, Texas. And it eventually led me into playing the guitar when I got a guitar at about 10, 11 years old. But I was playing piano at the time. That's my first instrument.
The American blues and folk legend and fabulous storyteller Ruthie Foster is in conversation today with oral historian Greg Borschmann. They're on stage at the Blue Mountains Music Festival, which is where we're bringing you ABC Radio National's Big Ideas from Today with me, Natasha Mitchell. I'm so loving this conversation. And it turns out the music world and her beloved audiences almost lost Ruthie to the US Navy to work as an engineer.
So I've asked you if you felt poor. Did you ever feel racism?
Racism?
Mm.
You bet. Mm. Oh, yeah.
How did it manifest?
I'll tell you my first experience. I was, I think maybe fourth grade, walk into my piano teacher had moved across the railroad tracks. And I was on my way to go see her. She was in a totally different neighborhood. And I remember knocking on the door and asking for her. And this white fella comes up and he just didn't say anything else to me. Turned around, went back into the house and said, somebody's at the front door and you might want to tell him to go around the back. Yeah. I was in fourth grade, you know, and I'm not sure of what I'm hearing, but then I realized, oh, okay, that's how it is. That's how it is, okay. But yeah, that was my first, you know, really, really becoming really aware, and it was directed at me, yeah.
What does that do to a 10-year-old girl? Does that help you understand the world and the way it is a little bit better? Does that make you angry? Does it make you frightened?
Yeah.
Does it make you pissed off?
Yeah, it's all of that. It is. It's all of it. You go through it all. And then when you come back to knowing who you are, again, having those strong black women around me and helping me to remember that you are worthy. And this particular teacher stood up for me too. It was a white teacher. And she was great with just helping me to get over that and realize that's not who I am. She helped me get into college. She helped me, yeah, she was with me all through high school.
Good white folk.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Apart from my husband. Mm-hmm. Strong black women, none could be stronger than Big Mama.
Big Mama. Hey, Big Mama. Yes. My Big Mama, my grandmother. Yeah, Big Mama was a big reader herself. She loved reading. And her sister, my Aunt Johnny, she was wheelchair bound. So whenever the groups would go to church, sometimes I would stay at Big Mama's house just so I could hang out with Aunt Johnny, because Aunt Johnny liked to sing, and she taught me how to answer the telephone. Johnson's Residence, may I help you? And, you know, she played with me, you know? It was fun to have this older woman who's so intelligent herself, and she knew when to, you know, it was time to play. And so I got the best of both worlds with my grandmother and my grandmother's sister. And, you know, I grew up with old people, so my way of thinking is a lot like that. It's about, you know, okay, you know what? Okay, you said that. Okay, I'm gonna take my time before I answer you. And that's a big one for me. Just put a speed bump before you say something. Put a speed bump in there. Think about what you're saying.
Very good advice. As a married man, I can tell you, excellent advice. I suspect she was very loving, but fearful.
Mm-hmm.
Were you fearful slightly of her?
Yeah, I was scared of her. I was scared of all the grown-ups in my family, but not scared to a point where I didn't...
Scared, respectful.
Yeah, very respectful.
Mm.
That was a must.
Mm.
And it still is in my family.
Mm.
I expect my daughter to respect not just elders, but older people.
And you've been listening to too much Aretha Franklin.
Is that it? Well, maybe we just come from the same kind of background.
I suspect so, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, because a lot of A lot of my upbringing was in the church. The church was where we got our news for the community. It was like our community center. And so I grew up not really wanting to be the front person in front of a choir, to being that person, because I had all of this nurturing coming from everyone in the church and the community. It's huge.
So this is the New Hope Missionary Baptist Church.
Wow, you know that.
Hallelujah. Tell us about the community that spawned that church, because without the community, you wouldn't have had the church.
True. Yeah, it was being a missionary church, it was our mission to make sure that folks who couldn't come to church, we would go and just visit with them. So sitting and visiting and bringing food to those who are they call it the sick and the shut in, and getting
the
chance.
The sick and the what?
Sick, shut in. Oh. When you shut in. This is anyway, I could go on with that. Mm. So you show up with a big plate of food and you just sit and visit. And I still do that to this day with friends of, you know, older friends of mine who, musicians, and they're in nursing facilities, rehabilitation centers. You know, you go and just sit and just chat and have, you know, bring them Oreo cookies or whatever they want. Yeah, it's a big deal. I grew up with that mentality, looking after your elders.
Last night at your show, you let the cat out of the bag because you made it very clear that it wasn't just about the food or the hymns. As Baptists, the dancing and the drinking happened after church.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. I still remember being in church and watching the brothers look, you know, the football game was coming on and they just, you know, watching their watches. And I noticed, you know, church would speed up a little bit on football games. I was like, oh, it's going to be a quick service today. Oh, yeah. And my uncles, they would take a little nip out by the post oak tree, and yeah, we knew what was going on. But that was still, it was all done respectfully. Mm.
Last night you also joked about watching the sisters in church rolling around, getting the Holy Ghost. Oh my goodness, that used to scare me to death.
Yeah, our church was very reserved. And, programmed, I guess you could call it. After I learned how to play the guitar and I started playing gospel music on guitar, I was a missionary sent to different churches to play in different churches, all types of churches, black churches, white churches, but the holiness churches in the tents, that was the most, it was fun. Because it was lively and people had drums and tambourines and people, you know, stood up to sing and people would get the Holy Ghost and just fall down and roll on the floor for a while. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm just going to keep playing. That's supposed to happen. You almost wait for it to happen because it's an energy that builds inside of the tent.
Yeah.
A tent revival is a big deal. Yeah.
And still is.
It still is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Still is. Yeah, I still remember watching one sister get up. She didn't say anything. She did a little spin, and then she just started running. And she was halfway to the road before anybody caught her. It's just, you know, the Spirit, the Holy Spirit would just catch people in different ways. And rolling around on the ground with some, speaking in tongues, that was part of it too. These weren't my churches, but I was a guest musician at these churches. Mm. And it was interesting.
What? It would have been very easy in some ways for you to just say, this is my place. Mm. This is where I belong. This is who I am.
Mm-hmm.
What drove you to join the Navy? Because surely that wasn't just because you wanted to travel the seven seas.
Right. I think that was part of it, but it was about getting out of the small town, which is what I found out when I got into the military. There were a lot of small town people in the military. just trying to get out. Everybody wanted to just be able to experience life.
Yeah.
And I didn't go into the Navy until after I finished college, because I promised my mother I would get a higher education first. And I'm glad I did that, because I actually went in, I was able to have more pay because I had the higher education, I had a college degree, and I had a different experience with life, you know. I lived a little bit. So by the time I got into the military, there were 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds, and I was already past that. So my mentality, my way of thinking in community, again, it was another community. When you get into the military, you take care of each other. I walked in with that way of thinking. But it was good for me to do that. I didn't do music at all.
You were an engineer.
Yeah, I was working on helicopters. It was something different. Yeah, I know, right? That's the way Big Mama taught me, you know, when life throws something at you, if you're interested in it, just say yes, try it out. You don't have to be there permanently. Just try it out. And I thought, I can do that. I know a little something about engines. So yeah, I ended up working on helicopters for a while. I separated myself from music because, again, I was a child playing music up until that time. So I needed a break. I wanted a break. And then music found me again. I was at my CO, my commanding officer's Christmas party. And the guys in the helicopter squad had a band at the party. And I noticed they had a singer there who was great. But then they went into a song called Red House. There's a red house over yonder. That's where my baby stays.
Oh.
And I thought, I can sing that. So I'm holding on to my punch and my sandwich, and I put it down, and I walk up and I start singing. And I sung for the rest of the night. They wouldn't let me leave. So the next Monday, that was the Saturday night, my commanding officer called me to his room, his office, and he had me stand at attention for 5 minutes, totally ignored me. It's what they do to command attention. And then finally he put me at ease. He put his pencil down and he says, "Why are you here at the helicopter squadron?" And I thought he was asking for, you know, you start spewing out what you're supposed to say. "Sir, I'm here to be the best person I can be." And he goes, no. "Why aren't you in the band? You do know the Navy has a band." "Yes, sir, I do know that." "Okay, are you interested in auditioning?" I could do that.
That was the right answer.
Yeah. "Yes, sir, I could do that." So he arranged for me to have an audition with the San Diego Navy band. And I got in on my birthday that February. I signed up for the band, got in, and they shipped me off to Norfolk, Virginia, to a music school. You have to go back into music school for 6 months. And so
what a privilege for you.
I went back to school.
what a gift.
Yeah.
At that stage of your life.
Right. I looked at it that way, too. A lot of the students did not. Because it was really hard. They strip the civilian away, and they want you to be a military musician, which is very, very different. It's very regimented, and it's hard. I thought getting through music school and college in Texas was hard. But this was tough. You had to be good to be in these bands. And I made it through. Yeah. So I decided to be a musician for the rest of my term in the Navy, and that was fun.
The Navy didn't know what they were buying into, surely.
They didn't know who was coming. They didn't know me. They didn't know what to do with me, really.
Texan-born singer-songwriter Ruthie Foster. She's known as a blues folk legend, but she's more eclectic than that. She's played big band-style shows, covered pop and funk hits, played in New York coffee shops and a whole lot more. And she's with us today on Big Ideas here on ABC Radio National and as podcast with me, Natasha Mitchell. We're coming to you from the Blue Mountains Music Festival, where Ruthie Foster is in conversation with Greg Borschman.
We talked before about the Deep South. How much was the military then, and we're talking about the 1980s by now, how much was the military a more inclusive space by that stage? Like, did you experience racism in the Navy?
Not so much. Not to my face, no. I experienced it when I married a Scott Irishman, and I was living in Charleston, South Carolina. I got it there, but in the military, no. It was we took care of each other. That's a whole nother family. Even when it came to, moving up in rank, no. It was about your credentials, and it was about how hard you worked.
So in that sense, it was almost colorblind.
Yes, but it wasn't always. I do know that some of my older officers experienced it, black officers experienced a really rough time. I do know that.
Ruthie, look, this is a challenging conversation, and I hope you don't find it too personal, but what were you thinking when you married a Scott Irishman?
Well, that came out of nowhere. Like my big mama said, just say yes.
No, sorry, I'm going to interject there. That wasn't the first good offer you'd had.
Oh, we're really going there? Okay.
Just briefly, just a little nugget.
Well, he was cute. Still is. Very intelligent.
You still talk?
I haven't talked to him in a while, but I used to call him on his birthday. We had this thing where on his birthday, I would wake him up with a different instrument every year. Whether I knew how to play it or not.
And you know what? If you had have stayed married, you would have never done that.
You know, it ended after I did it with the cymbals. That was it.
Oh, so he ended the marriage.
That was it. He had had enough. That's true.
Yeah. So how did that journey play out? You know, to be able to, and this is a really difficult road to navigate, to be able to say goodbye to someone, but to still remain civil. How did you navigate that journey?
I think we both realized that, you know, you get to this point where you realize that your paths are going different ways. Mm. Our path, you know, my path was leading me really back to my family. My mother was sick, and we were living in New Jersey, New York area, and I wanted to go back and look after my mother. And then his journey was leading more towards going up in his rank. He was really driven in making sure that he got his rank, staying in the military.
And you were meant to be the dutiful wife supporting him.
Right. It was a little bit of that. Yeah. And I was willing to do that if we could do it in the same place. But his led to the West Coast, San Francisco. And my journey led me back to my home. To see about my mother, to be my mother's daughter.
Yeah, okay, well, let's go there because, that was a pretty big choice. We should, just before we go there, just give me a thumbnail of New York, late 1980s, early 90s. What is Ruthie Foster's New York?
Yeah, I was signed with Atlantic Records. And my job was basically to write songs. It was a production deal more than anything.
You're a development artist.
A development artist.
Yes.
You know that. Yeah. And I had a great lawyer who spelled it out to me. He let me know, okay, you know, this is a development deal. So what you want to do is take advantage of having that Atlantic stamp anywhere you go under your name. And so that's what I did. I played around in New York in a village, and I worked on my songwriting. I worked on being able to entertain in these small bars, big bars, wrote a lot with, I did a lot of co-writing. Mm. That was really good for me. And really just getting to developing myself into a full-fledged entertainer. I used that time to do just that, a songwriter, entertainer.
Mm. Bob Dylan had been long gone. How had that milieu changed?
It's a great question. The Café Wa was still open.
Huh?
Yeah, they were on their last few years, but they still had, which is where Dylan frequented. A lot of songwriters would go and would use Café Wa to just try out new songs. And the place, the guy who owned the place wouldn't turn on the heat in the winter. So you basically went up in your coat and your hat, you know, it was cold. But it was Café Wa. You got a chance to sit on that stage where Dylan and Odetta and all these incredible songwriters were. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to visit all of these places. The Bitter End was still there, and I got a chance to be at the Bitter End like at least once a month with other songwriters. To me, it was about just getting a little bit of that juju in that area in particular.
You were so lucky just to catch the last gasp
just
of that.
Just the last
era.
Bit of it.
Yeah. Look, prepping for this conversation, I think the thing that surprised me most was that when you were there, a budding development musician, you were somehow influenced by Woody Guthrie. I kind of got that. Mm-hmm. But the Grateful Dead, how on earth were you influenced? How on earth was Ruthie Foster influenced by the Grateful Dead?
Well, you know, they had... But really just people who were fans of these bands that introduced me to this music. Even in Charleston, when I lived there, I would go to this little place and play guitar. It used to be a strip joint, but...
Just as long as they didn't ask you to do a double gig.
Well, here's what happened one night there. The guy who owned the place was always, he'd come through and, you know, I'd sing my song and I'd go sit and watch someone else sing. And there was hardly anybody coming into the place. It was really empty most of the time. And he would tell me, you know, if nobody shows up tomorrow night, I'm going to turn that sign around and you're going to have to take something off. So that I got real good at bringing people in, passing out flyers, make sure that there were people there. But yeah, you know, it was, I don't know, it's all an education, life. It's just saying yes to it, whatever.
Same.
Except taking my clothes off. I wasn't ready for that. They weren't ready for that.
No, I've always refused to go there too. Big decision to jump in your truck and to head south to say, you know, as Atlantic literally rings you up and says, honey, you've developed, we want you. Mm-hmm. You say, no, I'm going home.
Yeah, that's very same day I packed up.
That's a massive, massive decision.
I got a call from Anita Baker's producer, Barry Eastman, on my way home. Yeah.
One of the biggest in town.
Mm-hmm.
You were going home to your mum. She needed you.
I needed to go see to my mother. Yeah.
Lupus. What sort of disease is lupus?
Lupus. It's a blood disease. It's autoimmune disorder. Yeah. Yeah. She lived with that for quite some time, and back in the late 70s when they finally found out what it was, they just didn't know what it was. They were basically treating it in hospitals like it was AIDS. So my mother would be on the AIDS ward in a lot of these hospitals. And I gotta tell you, I was a young person. I remember sleeping in the waiting rooms because I didn't know, you know, being the oldest daughter, there have to be someone in a family who stayed in the hospital. And I still remember people covering me up with blankets in the waiting room. And I got to meet a lot of really beautiful people who were there visiting their loved ones. Mm. And they took care of me, being a younger person. And just making sure I was okay.
You know, if you hadn't have done that, you wouldn't have got the chance to have those final conversations with your mother.
Mm-hmm.
How important were they?
So important. I got to know my mother as a woman, not just my mom. So I got to hear her stories, and I got to hear what she was like at my age. And she shared that in the last 2.5 years that she had left on this earth. And I'm so glad I got a chance to see that side of her, because in a lot of ways it brought forgiveness. And she did ask me, you know, baby, just forgive me for not being the best parent I could have been. It was just huge. It was so healing for both of us. And at the same time, I would make sure that she was visiting her own mother, my big mama. So I would go, I'd play on Saturday nights. This was in Bryan College Station. Again, I took another break from music and I worked at a TV station, and I made sure my apartment was next to where her nursing home facility was. She was 53 when she passed, so she's very young. So I would pick her up on Saturdays and then take her back, go play music. I would stop by her room there in the nursing room, because she's a hairdresser, and let her do my hair. And she would jack my hair to Jesus, because it'd just be teased out to here, because that's what she knew, 60s, you know. You know, everything's teased. So I'd walk out of there, and the folks at the nursing station would watch me and go, "Ooh, girl, your mama did your hair tonight." And that was Saturday night. And I'd go back to pick her up for church the next morning. And I remember hustling and trying to get her into the truck, you know, and get her walker. And she stopped me and she grabbed me by the arm and she just said, "Baby, I'm so proud of you." And that's what I needed to, I didn't know I needed to hear that.
Yeah, that's all you needed to hear. Yeah.
And we get, you know, back to hustling. Yeah. Getting her back to Big Mama.
Your first album actually came out a year after she died. How hard was that?
That was tough, yeah. I'm still getting over. You don't get over it, but...
No, you never do.
Just trying to get my feet back into music.
Was she in that somehow, in those songs or in that album, or did you just have to sort of park that to one side?
She was everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, the night she passed, she went right through me. I still remember that.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Did she say goodbye on the way through?
Oh, in so many ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And then I happen to be that connected to my mother and to my dad, who's still here. I put her into the music. Every album that I do, there's at least one song dedicated to her, her memory, or even her voice. I'll sing it in her voice. Because she was a beautiful singer. Mm-hmm. I thought she was Aretha Franklin when I was little. Because she'd sing everywhere. She'd sing when she was doing dishes. She'd sing when she was cooking. And I loved the way she sang. She'd put on that stereo. You know, I talked about the console stereo. And she'd walk around snapping her fingers. And when mama's happy, the house is happy, right? It was just, it was amazing how connected we were. And so, yeah, every album I try to put at least some of her in, just a sprinkle.
Yeah. Everyone was a singer. Like, you know, you described catching the school bus with 22 cousins.
You know that, yeah. Oh, these cousins. Ooh, singing cousins. Yeah.
And not just singing, I'm talking four-part harmony.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, on the bus. Because we live so far from the middle schools and the high school, you'd have 10 miles, maybe 12 miles of just bus ride. And so, yeah, then my cousins would start singing, people say I'm the life of the party, I tell a joke or two. And then you'd hear other, ooh. Someone would start and everybody would just finish. Those were my bus rides, yeah.
You've come home. You live in Austin, Texas, in a modest house in South Austin. Mm-hmm. How different is life now than it was then in the 1960s and 1970s for a little Ruthie growing up?
How different? Life from there to now? Wow.
I'm not just talking about you. I'm talking about America. I'm talking about that place. I'm talking about that community. How different is it?
Well,
because you've my sense is you've lost something. That sort of family and community that you grew up with, that absolute surety.
Yeah, it is different. Well, the store is still there, which I'll pop by once in a while. Yeah, the town is actually smaller now than it was. It was 500 population when I was there. So that says something. I think that has more to do with jobs or in other places than anything. A lot of my family, they're still there. So I do visit, but it is a different climate. It's interesting, the division that we're seeing with the states, you actually see it in some of the small communities too. And I was real sad to see that. It's not so much talked about, but you feel it. And it's very palpable.
You've got a 13-year-old daughter, Maya. How has she changed her life?
How has Maya changed her life?
Your life.
My life? Oh, Maya saved my life.
What?
Yeah, you know, okay, we're going there. Yeah, because, you know, I was in a partnership with a younger woman who wanted to have kids. And I was not.
Ready. Not ready.
Not ready. And
Not ever.
I can't have, unfortunately, I can't have my own biological kids.
This is Katie.
This is Katie. Yeah. And we're still very, very good friends. We're not together now, but still co-parenting Maya right now. And I thought, you know, I could give a kid something.
You could be a big mama.
I could be a big mama. Hey. So, yeah, I said yes. And it changed the way I look at, you know, with kids, it takes the spotlight away from you, and it's about them. It ain't about you anymore. Still not about me when I'm home.
It's 13, I would imagine, very much so.
And she's just a beautiful kid. I mean, she popped out just, you know, hey, I'm here now. Let the party start. And she's so social. She's smart. She loves music. She's a beautiful singer herself.
Do I feel a co-tour coming on? You know, have you got a good support artist there?
We might. We might. Though I'd rather she go into something else.
Yeah.
I really would. You know, just experience life, you know, the way I did. Just have fun with whatever you want to do.
You don't want her singing the blues all her life.
No. And, you know, singing the blues for me is not so, it's not, you know, my baby done left me. And it's not that, because blues fills my heart.
Yeah.
Blues is so close to gospel for me.
Yeah.
And
it's
you guys,
joy. It's
yeah,
joy.
It is joy.
Yeah.
And if anything, blues is it's a witness to your life. It's a witness. Because, you know, I've been there. You know, when Katie and I split up, that was a really tough time with a kid, too. And I remember connecting back to T-Bone Walker, you know, and the songs that I do now, Mississippi John Hurt, because it brings it back to basics. And that's why I say blues is a witness. I used it as a witness to what I'm going through. And then you've got your, you know, your B.B. Kings and the blues that's up-tempo. And blues when you're feeling fine. That one uncle that had way too many and he wants to sing some blues. Blues is that too. Blues is sway. Blues is gospel in a lot of ways for me.
Ruthie, when I asked you the question about sort of South Austin and sort of America then and America now, I was actually thinking of Maya, about how you imagine, because you want your children to grow up feeling safe. You want your children to be able to live in a world where they can reach their potential. How much do you worry now about the America that Maya is growing up into?
I'm concerned. She's concerned. And I can see where schools are actually creating a space for kids to talk now. She's in middle school, so eighth grade. And I think that's really important for the young people right now because, you know, they're feeling it too in the household, especially. And especially a world where you live in where kids have to have a drill for if there's a shooter in the school. You know, we get the email to just so we know what's going on in a school in case
the
kid.
It's only a drill.
Right, right. It's a really weird and wild place to be right now and not where I would have ever gone to in my head before having a kid. But here we are. This is reality. Kids are definitely growing up quicker now. She's aware and she knows she's safe and she knows that, you know, I'll go mama bear on anybody when it comes to anybody messing with my kid. Her friends know this. I'm Mama Yaya. She calls me Yaya. So they know.
What haven't you done? What do you want to do?
I would love to score for a film someday.
Sounds like a bit of a job application, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would love to do that.
Any film producers in the audience?
Yeah. I really would love to do that. I love movies. I pay more attention to not just the music, but having a background in video and TV production. I love all of that about movies. So yeah, I would love to do that. There are a few other things. Who knows? May not have anything to do with music, but I hope it does.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think Ruthie Foster has done Big Mama proud. I think she's done her mother proud. Ladies and gentlemen, what a privilege. Thank you, Ruthie, for coming all the way from South Austin to tell us that story. Yeah. One more time, folks, Ruthie Foster.
Wowee, hey. Grammy Award-winning blues folk singer-songwriter Ruthie Foster, a true Heartlands Conversation, which is a series hosted at the Blue Mountains Music Festival by Greg Borschman, who is a writer, broadcaster and oral historian for the National Library of Australia. If you want to join me and an audience at a live event that we're recording for Big Ideas, just head to our homepage, scroll on down to the bottom and look for Be In Our Audience click through, and I'm always updating that list. You can email us your thoughts about what you hear on the show. We love getting notes and feedback from you. You can send them to bigideas@abc.net.au. I'm Natasha Mitchell, looking forward to joining you next time for more Big Ideas and maybe more music.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.